I'm Kara Miller, and this is Boston Public Radio. Last year, the number of female Fortune 500 CEOs hit an all-time high, around 3.2%. Not too impressive, given that women comprise just about half the workforce. So what's going on here? Are women themselves opting out of careers? Are they being judged unfairly in the workplace? To answer these questions and a lot more, I'm joined first by Betsy Myers, the founding director of the Center for Women and Business at Bentley. Betsy Myers, thanks for being here.
Great. Thanks, Kara.
So let me just start with that. Why are 97% of Fortune 500 CEOs men? And I should say, if you expand it out and look at not just the 500 biggest companies, but about the 3,000 companies that are publicly traded, it's almost exactly the same numbers. About 3% of CEOs
right.
are women.
And we haven't made much progress in the last 15, 20 years, which
That's
is
right.
pretty stunning, actually. I think it's an issue that we're all trying to figure out, and there's no easy answers to it. Here's the secret code, right? But I think there's an issue. Well, what's exciting right now is that corporate America, many of the companies are saying, wait a minute, the workforce has changed. 70% of new entrants into the workplace last year were women and people of color. And, wow, our customers are women. 85% of spending is by women. And so how can we do better with this? And so there's this change of conversation because they're mostly male CEOs are saying, what are the things we need to do to keep our women in the pipeline? Because why do we have this leaky pipeline? So that we can have more candidates to be CEOs. And that's the shift in conversation that's going on.
And we do see now more law school grads, more
yes.
college grads are women. So you talk about a leaky pipeline. What accounts for the leaks in the pipeline?
Well, I think, it's partly women are it's a lifestyle in corporate America. And I think Anne-Marie Slaughter's article at The Atlantic was so telling. And I actually agreed with everything she said, which is there's a certain point where women say, wait a minute, I'm a whole human being here and working 60, 70 hours a week to get up the pipeline when I have a family or other things. And here's the thing, too. It's not just about women having children. It's about having a whole life. Because men, too, say, wait, I have issues. I have aging parents. I have a child that has needs. I have other things in my life. And so I think women, and here's what actually I think, that so often we as women, our whole being and our whole self-esteem isn't based totally on our job. That we actually have things outside of the job that give us our kind of our self-esteem and who we are. And so women are opting out to not leave completely, or sometimes we'll leave a couple years, starting their own businesses, choosing a lifestyle that allows them to be able to maybe raise a family or have a life outside of the workplace.
Let's jump right into that Anne-Marie Slaughter discussion. We actually have a clip of her. She's a professor at Princeton who famously wrote in The Atlantic just very recently that women still can't have it all. And here she is actually reacting to the news that Marissa Mayer was named the CEO of Yahoo, and is also going to be having a baby in October, and she's on Meet the Press's Press Pass. Let's listen to her.
I think it's terrific, and I applaud her, and any woman who makes it to the top, I applaud. I want more women at the top. But I actually think she confirms a lot of what I was saying, because I actually say women who are superhuman, rich, and in charge of their own time can do it. It's just that that's kind of a very high bar. And I don't think it makes sense to say to most women, make CEO by 37 and then have kids. For most women, they're having kids before then. They need to take time. We need more flexible arrangements. But mm-hmm. I'm all for what she achieved. I just don't think that it applies to the majority of women.
I'm also joined by Judy Shenfilman, principal and founder of Dreambridge Partners, and Lottie Balin, professor emeritus at MIT Sloan. And Judy Shenfilman, make sense a little bit of this, of Marissa Mayer getting to be CEO of Yahoo. What did you think when you heard it?
Well, I think in terms of, for her, if this is what she wants and this is what thrills her, all the power to her. That's fantastic. And I think some other women may say, this is not exactly what I'm looking for. So I think all of us need to applaud and celebrate those people that get to a position like this at a very great young age of 37, and she chooses to have a baby during that time. If that works for her, we should all be celebrating that. And for a man that says, I don't want that, that's also okay. What we have to recognize to what you're talking about is that corporate America has a culture. And that culture has a history that happens to be in the United States. And that culture does tend to reward. If you look at, in the United States, what does culture of power look like? It is a Caucasian male that is a really has given everything up in his life in the pursuit of the cause. That's really what we still think heroism and culture of power looks like today.
That's what the success looks like. That's what the CEO looks like.
The corporate CEO, right? And it's really today still, if you look at it, it's the pyramid with the one person at the very, very top that's make all the decisions. And the reality of most of the world today is that we're in matrix organizations with multiple people making decisions. And so what happens then is it does take a particular type of person who's going to want to make it. And the reality is, given the way that our society is changing, given the way that cultural expanse is happening in the world, we have to rethink of what does really, really powerful people who are going to make truly great executive decisions look like. It happened maybe a woman, but I also challenge that there's an opportunity for us to look at different ways of making decisions. That may be that rather than having a pyramid, we look at trapezoids. Maybe there are more ways to have women that are in. So I really do challenge for all of us to use the word opt out. What I say is that companies have not allowed women and those that choose to have a different lifestyle to opt in. And therefore, it is a great loss on the part of corporate America to not be maintaining those with the highest talent. So then what you're left with is those that are willing to deal with this kind of perspective of ascension and power. This is why almost half of all small businesses are run by women, right? We account for almost 18 million workers, up to $3 trillion in revenues. And what's interesting for women that are starting businesses, they're 40 to 46, which means they've actually gone up their career ladder, have a lot of experience, and for some interesting reason, they decide, I'm going to go out on my own. So I think we need to really look at that as we move forward.
And maybe they have older children who are now able to do more on their own, and they can finally...
Exactly. And so they're opting in to still pursue their dreams and their careers, but in a different configuration.
So, Lottie Balin, to go back to Marissa Mayer, she's appointed to the CEO job at Yahoo. It's amazing. Then we hear her say that she's having a baby, she's going to take a few weeks of maternity leave, but she's going to work through it. What did you think when you heard that?
Well, I thought it was wonderful. I was delighted that she has one of the top jobs, and I was delighted that she's also having a baby. And obviously, she has all the means, as have been said, to be able to do it.
Yeah, a net worth of about $300 million,
exactly.
So she can clearly get some help, right?
But I want to continue on what we've been talking about, that there's no reason that I can see why a CEO necessarily does the best work by being always at the workplace, by being always accessible. And though that is the culture, that's the culture we know, and I think we have to challenge that. In fact, we know that if managers or leaders or CEOs are too much on top of everything, it's a detriment to the people who are actually doing the work. That being a little bit away and apart from surveillance allows people to make the decisions at lower levels, which is where usually the information lies, where decisions should be made. So I think we need to think about the culture, we need to think what we need in leaders, and we need to think how the work is organized. And I think it's not only a problem for women, but it's also a problem for men. And when we talk about women have choice, they can start a small business, what that means is that the men in their lives don't have that choice. And we need to create both a culture and a workplace where people can have these kinds of choices. And that means that we have to rethink very systematically the way we think that work needs to be done, the way we think that leaders need to behave. And if we're willing to challenge some of those very taken-for-granted assumptions and to begin to make some changes, I think everyone will benefit, not only the employees, but the business itself.
I want to get back to that question of corporate culture in just a minute. Let me say, though, that I'm Kara Miller. This is Boston Public Radio, and we are talking about women and business and why they are only 3% of CEOs. And we're joined on the line by Sridhari Desai, a research fellow at Harvard's Kennedy School and assistant professor at the University of North Carolina. Sridhari Desai, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So you've done a really, really interesting study about the way that married men, so you really focused on men here, the way that they look at women in the workplace. And before you sort of get into what you found in the study, which is striking, what inspired you to want to do the study in the first place?
So I was raised in India, and I noticed that, of course, in India we have a very strong tradition where often women are sidelined. And so it would not be unusual when visiting my grandparents, for instance, to observe that the men folk had their lunch and dinner first, and then the women and the female children would eat whatever was left. And I come from a well-to-do family, so there was always enough to eat. But this kind of attitude that women were second in line was also obvious when important decisions had to be made in the family. Women were supposed to be in the shadows and not encouraged to voice their opinions. However, I did have one uncle who was very different from the crowd. He was more encouraging of women. He would say, "Hey, can I help out in the kitchen?" And, "Hey, why don't you all sit down with me when I'm eating?" and so forth. And one thing that was different about this uncle was that his wife was a working woman. And I wondered later on if the fact that he was different from the pack was because he was witnessing that his wife could also bring home something valuable, that she was also a human being who was, a person in her own right and not to be sidelined. So that, in part, led to this research.
Yeah, the idea that personal experience so much shapes how we think about our world. So yeah, so tell us a little bit about how do you judge how married men think about women in the workplace?
So when I first approached Arthur, Arthur is a co-author of mine, and so is Dolly Chigg. Arthur is at University of Utah and Dolly is at NYU Stern. When I approached Arthur, he pointed me to an archival data set here in the U.S. that records opinions about Americans on a whole set of dimensions, including gender issues. And he asked me to go ahead and, examine the data set to see what was going on. Interestingly enough, in this data set, which is the General Social Survey data set, what I found was that those men who were married to stay-at-home wives, they tended to have more of a negative attitude towards the presence of women in the workplace. They tended to think that a woman should stay at home, raise babies, and take care of her husband's career, be supportive of him, as opposed to try and have a career of her own. So this was somewhat surprising to me, because I thought that the U.S. would be different from India, for instance.
Let me just go to Judy Shen-Fillerman for a second. I saw you nodding there. Does this surprise you, the findings of this study?
Well, I think in terms of what it doesn't surprise me is the fact that we really all have particular cultural habits and ways that we think. And indeed, what you just said, this notion of that our personal experience shape how we think, is that if you look at the demands of anybody at a very senior executive level, man or woman, you really need to have a full-time person at home to take care of the rest of the family. And so if you look at the fact that if married men, that again, if you look at senior executives who are men, the majority of them are married, right? And senior executive women, there are more of them not married and married without children. So that's just interesting stats out there. But I think the reason I was nodding is because of that particular perspective, it may start to help them think, they start to think about what is relevant. Just kind of a little flip of that is, when you look at the men who are in senior positions, these are for women that I have coached, and frankly, my days at Corporate America, where I've had a lot of my mentors, which are all senior men, by the way, Caucasian, and those that had daughters that were coming of age, coming to their 20s, you see quite a bit of change in the way they perceive the women that are working with them. I look at that as a real positive, but it could also really, again, talk to the fact that how we experience our lives affect how we think about others. And if that is a perspective of this negativity that, you know, if I'm going along with what the researcher, this, I'm sorry, your name, but who's working on this research, is this notion of, if we really believe at the end of the day that a woman is there to help us and to serve us, what does that look like when she becomes my peer at the very senior executive level? And one of the things I want to kind of build on this is that I also put women as responsible in this play, which is that if you look at, you know, the numbers out there, which is that more women are graduating from college, going to law school, it is all based on competency. How smart I am, how intelligent I am. And that serves us really, really well in the first 5 years of our career. As you get more and more senior, it is not about competency, because you would not be there if you were not highly competent. What becomes really, really important to get to those senior, the upper third of the pyramid, is about your degree of influence. Can I influence you about opinions, which is not about competency of data? It's about, can I just convince you about something? And frankly, at the very senior level, it's really about, can I hang out with you? How do I feel if I'm with you? This notion of, can I be collegial with you? So some of the women that I'm working with and have worked with, it's this notion of, how do you create personal relationships with those people that are in power, and to not focus simply on the competency and the work at hand, but really establishing this kind of collegial relationship that, again, you know, we're all social beings. So if you're looking at the men playing golf, doing tennis, it's much easier to do that. You insert a woman in that mix, and it's challenging. So I think that is where some of the challenges really are in terms of this men-women paradigm.
We're talking about women in the workplace, what's working, what isn't, and what will it take to improve the culture for both men and women. And I'm talking to Judy Shenfillerman, Lottie Balin, and Sridhri Desai, and we're going to be back and talk more about that research showing the difference between the way married men with stay-at-home wives view things and with married men with wives who work. I'm Kara Miller, and you're listening to Boston Public Radio.
And the Fairmont Copley Plaza, proud sponsor of the Boston Globe WGBH Summer Arts Weekend, offering updated guest rooms, meeting spaces, a rooftop health club, and an anticipated new restaurant. Fairmont.com/Copley Plaza.
I'm Kara Miller. This is Boston Public Radio. We're talking about the workforce with a focus on women and what it will take to improve the working environment and working culture to get them to the CEO office. And let me come back to you, Sridhri Desai, and your work on married men who have stay-at-home wives versus married men who have working wives. Now, you said there was a difference in how they viewed women in the workplace in terms of married men with stay-at-home wives viewing women in the workplace a little more negatively. Was it a big difference? How did you quantify it?
So first of all, there was a statistical difference in the attitudes. But more importantly, there's also an economic difference, I would say, because subsequently we ran a study where we had men in different kinds of marriages evaluate two different underlings, David and Diane. And they had to decide whom to send to an MBA to a company-sponsored MBA program. And the two underlings, David and Diane, had identical CVs. So the participants were presented these CVs, and they had to make a recommendation whom to send. It turned out that men who were in traditional marriages were more likely to go ahead and suggest that David be sent to the program and not so much Diane. Her evaluations were significantly lower, even though her CV was fairly identical to that of David.
And when you say traditional, when you say traditional marriages, you mean men with stay-at-home wives, right?
That's correct, yes. I mean men with stay-at-home wives. Not only that, we also looked at a different study where we had men, and these were undergraduate men who were about to graduate and they were searching for jobs. So we showed them the description of a company called Indisco, and we said that, this was a firm that had an equal opportunity or equal employment program. And we either made it salient that there were a fair number of women on the board of directors, or we were silent about that. And we also manipulated the names of the recruiters who would be coming to campus. Either the names were all masculine or they were feminine. And it turned out that those men who were in traditional marriages were less likely to find the organization attractive if the names of the recruiters were feminine and if the board of directors had a significant percentage of women.
Fascinating.
So all in all, it's a little disappointing to see that men in these marriages might be non-consciously prejudiced or, biased towards women in the workplace.
Let me go to Lottie Balin here from MIT. I can see you want to get in.
Well, I found this a fascinating study, and I found the one encouraging thing was in your figure one, where you showed that if the percentage of women in the workplace was high, all the men, in no matter which of the structures they were in, felt that the workplace was functioning more smoothly. So I found that encouraging, that maybe if you get enough women in the workplace, the bias that these traditional men give, it can somehow be compensated for. And I was fascinated by that. And it was the one comforting thing in your study.
Sridhar, did that give you comfort too?
Yes, it did. And also more recently, I have been looking at a longitudinal data set. This is a British data set, and therein I find that I'm able to look at men's attitudes before they ever got married, and then I get to see what happened to those attitudes towards women after they got married. And it is very comforting for me to find that after men with very sort of traditional conservative views towards women, after they get married, and let's say that they do get married to somebody who ends up finding a job and working full-time, then these men's attitudes get softened. They are no longer quite as prejudiced. So that was something interesting that I noted. Previously, there was some mention on the show about how having maybe daughters may change attitudes as well. In my study, I did not actually find any effect on the presence of daughters on men's attitudes towards women, but there is recent research that suggests that it is not the number of daughters that a man may have that may influence his attitudes. Rather, it is the gender of the firstborn child. So if the firstborn is a daughter, then there might be more of a softening, more of a other valued attitude in general.
Again, this notion that you're so shaped by your own life, your own experiences. One more question for you, Sridhar. I know that you have a young child at home, and I'm wondering what having a child has, if it sort of added any kind of dimension to the research that you're doing and sort of the way that you think now about male-female dynamics in the workplace and taking time off, which we were just talking about before you joined us.
That's a very cute and interesting question at the same time. So I'd like to say that my research has informed my personal life and vice versa, and I'll explain in a minute. When I started this project several years ago, I did not have a child, and what I did find on analyzing the data was that men who had working mothers when they were growing up, well, I thought that having a working mom would make a man sympathetic towards women's cause and sympathetic towards the presence of women in the labor force, but there was no effect. And post hoc, Arthur, Dolly, and I, we thought that perhaps the reason was that when these men were growing up, yes, they did see that mom went to work, but when they got home from school, it was their mom who was doing things such as folding the laundry, making sandwiches for dinner, and so forth. And perhaps not seeing an egalitarian distribution of domestic work between the father and the mother may have somehow not caused these men to be aware of the challenges that women face in the workforce and how important it is for them to work. So one thing that I'm going to do differently because of my research is that I'll make sure that my son Max sees that both his father and I share the domestic burden and that he sees his dad cook dinner for him sometimes, that his dad is the one who is helping him out with homework, attending PT, and so forth. And that he realizes that it is both father and mother that carry the weight equally, both outside the home as well as inside of it.
Shudri Desai, research fellow at Harvard's Kennedy School and an assistant professor at the University of North Carolina, thank you so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
And we're talking about women in the workforce. What is it going to take to move the needle from 3% of Fortune 500 CEOs, which is where we are right now? And Lottie Balin from MIT, I could see when Shudri was talking about mothers working and how men are influenced by that, they were particularly interested in that.
I was, because a study I did some time ago, and it was some time ago, so I don't know if it would show now. It showed that the men whose mothers were working had more of a tendency to want traditional wives, and the men whose mothers had not been working had more of a tendency to want wives who also were working. It's almost as if they found complications in their own lives, and they wanted more or less the opposite. So it was interesting that...
Betsy Myers, director of the Center for Women and Business at Bentley. I wonder, I mean, we're talking about, you know, women being mothers and the complications that provides. Do you hear people talking about maternity leave as an issue, when it's so striking? Only four countries out of the world's 178 don't have paid maternity leave: the U.S., Papua New Guinea, Liberia, and Swaziland. Everybody else does.
I know. It is amazing, isn't it? Even our U.S. government doesn't provide that, federal government. It is amazing. But yeah, do we talk about it? Yes, people talk about it. But I think I hear the conversation more about once we have our children, how we then deal with being present in the home and present at the workplace. And that's really the conversation. It's not this old conversation of balance. You know, I think that's kind of tired. What the new conversation about this is how do we have an integrated life? Because it's more of this acknowledgement, like, yes, we have a family outside of work. Yes, we have children. And also this acknowledgement that what our children need when they're babies change when they're 5, change when they're 10, and sometimes change when they're teenagers. And we have to adjust accordingly as parents to be there for what our children need. And so that's also how can the workforce kind of surround their employees with support and acknowledgement that, yes, we do have families.
Well, when you hear somebody like Marissa Mayer say, you know, I'm essentially going to take very, very little time off, is she really saying, hey, that's the standard? I mean, that's what Yahoo expects of me. And if you want to be a CEO, just like, you know, all the male CEOs, you're going to have to not take time off either.
Well, I think it's just her situation particularly is that, wow, just happened to be pregnant and I got this job. It's like the golden ring, right? And so how do I accommodate for this at this time, because it's such an incredible opportunity? And what's exciting about her appointment is that the selection committee chose her not because she was a woman, but because she brought an expertise to the table around product development, which they believe is what they need for the future. They've had 5 CEOs over the last 5 years, all men, that have all lasted a year. And now they said, here is someone who we think is going to take us into the future. Oh, and by the way, she happens to be pregnant. And so that's what's exciting about that conversation, is that it didn't get in the way of their selection. And then how she manages it is up to her. I mean, obviously she's been successful to this point, and we'll let her manage how she deals with her her baby.
Although, Judy Chen-Tolman, that has been controversial. The question, one of the interesting questions is, when a woman gets a job as CEO, at least in the Marissa Mayer case, is it because the job was so deeply undesirable and the company was so on the rocks that, you know, they're not, I mean, they may not be taking that big a chance on a woman because they're already in trouble?
I think people can choose how they want to think about that. I think for those that choose to think that way, it's very, very unfortunate. No one gets to be CEO of Yahoo because, gosh, let's see, just aren't a whole lot of really talented people out there. Oh, here's a woman. Let's go for her. Right? So if they choose to think that way, that's the way they choose. I say she has clearly done phenomenal as a female engineer in Google, one of the earlier ones starting out, having the gusto not to be doing what she's doing. I say, sure, she may take 3 weeks, but I also encourage her, bring your nanny along. Maybe have a crib in your office. Have a nursing room if you choose to breastfeed. To Anne-Marie Slaughter's point, she has the power, the prestige to make the call of how she chooses to lead in her depiction of herself as a woman. And I think it could say a lot of things to society in general if she chooses to have the nursing room right there and say, excuse me, I can't have my meeting right now because I have to go pump.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
I mean, seriously. So this, she has a lot of opportunity here right now to set the stage about redefining what it means to be a CEO with a baby. And I really do think that a lot of this conversation, we have the opportunity for women in general to, you know, stop waiting to be asked to the dance. Okay.
I want to get back to this question of a leaky pipeline because it is very interesting to me, like, what creates the leaks? How do you have, right, women who are 50% of the workforce and then about 15% of upper executives and then 3% of CEOs? Where are the leaks coming in? I want to play a couple of clips from Sheryl Sandberg, another big person in the tech world. She's the chief operating officer of Facebook. And first, I'm going to play a clip of her sort of talking about the problem as she sees it. This is from 2010, and she's giving a talk at TED.
We still have a problem, and it's a real problem. And the problem is this. Women are not making it to the top of any profession anywhere in the world. The numbers tell the story quite clearly. 190 heads of state, 9 are women. Of all the people in parliament in the world, 13% are women. In the corporate sector, women at the top, C-level jobs, board seats, tops out at 15, 16%. The numbers have not moved since 2002 and are going in the wrong direction.
And Lottie Bale, I'm going to play a little story from Sheryl Sandberg. Same talk, 2010, where she's talking about the reality of being a woman in a sort of high-ranking corporate leader world when there are so few others.
A couple of years ago, I was in New York, and I was pitching a deal. And I was in one of those fancy New York private equity offices you can picture. And I'm in the meeting. It's about a three-hour meeting. And 2 hours in, there's kind of needs to be that bio break, and everyone stands up. And the partner running the meeting starts looking really embarrassed. And I realize he doesn't know where the women's room is in his office. So I start looking around for moving boxes, figuring they just moved in, but I don't see any. And so I said, so did you just move into this office? And he said, no, we've been here about a year. And I said, are you telling me that I am the only woman to have pitched a deal in this office in a year? And he looked at me and he said, yeah, or maybe you're the only one who had to go to the bathroom.
Lottie Balin from MIT Sloan, what's happening with the leaky pipe?
Well, one thing that is not happening, and I thought you might play this, because my understanding is that one of the things she said is that there's an ambition gap. That women don't have the ambition. None of the data that we have confirms that. If you asked the MBAs or the junior managers, the women and men equally want to go to the top and to get top positions. And so what happens is that two things, the expectations of what you have to do that job, which are old-fashioned, are not keeping up with the times, and there still are those gender stereotypes and gender biases that exist. So those two things combined make it more difficult for women, and they may decide, as some men, if they had the choice, might decide that they'd rather do something else.
So you're saying, in a sense, we think of women as sort of opting out because they want to have kids. And I should say here that that statistics show that about two-thirds of married men in high corporate offices do have kids, but only about one-third of married women in high corporate offices have kids. So we always think sort of women opt out to have kids. But are you saying part of the thing is they're opting out because they're not getting anywhere? Because they're not getting where they want to be.
They're being pushed out. They are unable to do the job that they want to do and that they know they have the competence for, given the conditions of expectations and assumptions, which in fact are probably not helping the work itself.
And is it reasonable to have the kind of expectations that we... So one of the expectations we tend to have, I think, of CEOs is that they're always available, that they're always on tap. Does that make sense either for men or for women?
It makes no sense because it means that people get over-dependent on the higher-up people. They don't do anything on their own. There's no learning in that organization. And so it also leads to a sort of firefighting mode. People don't have to take the time to think out what they're going to do, how they're going to get it done. They're sort of waiting for somebody to tell them, yes, this is okay, or do it this way. So from the work point of view, it's not the best way to manage an organization.
Judy Schoenfeldman, last comment here.
I think in terms of what you're talking about, Leahy, pipeline, there are two things going on. One is, and I think both men and women or organizations need to all take responsibilities. From the women's perspective, we know that we are not the best self-promoters. And it is also very clear that if you're going to get to the senior top third of the triangle, you've got to self-promote. Here's what I've done. Here's what I've done. Here's what I've done. And not, I was saying before, don't wait to be asked to the dance. I'm going to go. Here's what I want. Put your hand up. Take the risk. So what if it doesn't exactly work? We've got to be able to do that. Organizations, on the other hand, got to see this as a real threat to their talent management talent pool. And the opportunities they have is at every juncture from individual contributor to management to executive, what are they doing to help them get the sponsorship, which we know is critical. Two is, as you get to these senior positions, informal network, do I know you and how well do I know you outside of the meetings is critical. Are the HR folks, our senior executives, going out and making a point of meeting these talented young women, say, we want you here? And when we know that women in their 30s are going to have kids and are committed to having kids, then we have to start thinking about not just do we help them ramp down, how to get them back in a way that we know in a new configuration that they can still contribute their very, very talented capabilities, but in a configuration that works for a multitude of preferences.
Yeah, so we're not losing half the talent pool.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much. We've been talking about the future of women in the workforce, and I've been speaking with Betsy Myers, the founding director of the Center for Women and Business at Bentley, Judy Schoenfeldman, principal and founder of DreamBridge Partners, Lottie Balin, professor emeritus at MIT Sloan, and I spoke earlier with Sridhri Desai, research fellow at Harvard's Kennedy School and an assistant professor at the University of North Carolina. Thanks so much to all of you.
Thank you.
And Callie Crossley is back in Studio 3. Callie, it looks like you're going to be looking at America through the eyes of an interesting duo.
That's right. I'll be talking to Meghan McCain. She and the liberal comedian Michael Ian Black traveled across the country together and recorded their observations and experiences in a new book.
So what is their verdict on the country? Are we divided? Are we frustrated? Are we optimistic?
All of the above.
Okay, I'll be listening. I'm Kara Miller.
I'm Callie Crossley, and this is Boston Public Radio.